Welcome to the Caribbean Property Investing Podcast, where we share real-life experiences for successful Caribbean property entrepreneurs. Learn about their successes, challenges, and strategies to help you create your plan for financial freedom. Now let's get started.
I love my community. It teaches you the importance of being together even through difficult times. Business owners doing their best to make it through. Fishermen and farmers working hard to put food on our tables. Nurses caring for the sick shows me who we are made of. People who care. I guess it's about growing together.
To ruminate, to create your ultimate living space. And at Courts, you'll find what you need. Choose from our wide range of furniture, electronics, and accessories to complete your space. We're here and ready to assist. Give us a call to place your order. Shop online at shopcourts.com or visit us in store. So ruminate at Courts, bringing value home.
Welcome to episode 18 of the Caribbean Property Investing Podcast. Thank you for your support. Continue sharing, liking, and let other people know about the content that we provide. Every week, we try to bring information that is educational, entertaining, enlightening to our audience. In episode 15, I believe, we heard from Carlene Purcell, the Deputy Director of the Citizenship by Investment Program from Grenada, and the uniqueness of that program. We got some good feedback from the audience. Of course, there were some viewers and listeners who thought that going the CBI or the CIP route was a little too advanced for them. And that's okay, because our audience is varied. We have a wide range of persons interested in property investing, from the simple apartment below your home to commercial offerings to real estate investment trusts, the REITs, as we would have gone through in previous episodes. Today, as a solution, I'm proud to present to you the CEO of the Citizenship by Investment Program for St. Lucia, Mr. Nestor Alfred. Welcome, Nestor.
It's really a pleasure to be here with you today.
Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself, your background, and ultimately how you got to your current position, which is very, very important and critical at this point in time, CEO of St. Lucia CIP.
You know, my career prior to CIP has always been within the financial services sector. So I have touched virtually every component of the financial services that one can think of. And then, of course, I also had a regulatory stint. So my career first started off with being an auditor with an accounting firm, Panalco Foster, many years ago when I first left A-Level College. And then I moved over to doing my first degree. And then I came back to St. Lucia and then worked with the Inland Revenue Department for a period of about 10 years. At that time, I was the Assistant Comptroller of Inland Revenue. I then left and went into banking. And my banking career started off in Barbados. And then I did this for a number of years, then moved over to Cayman Islands with the same bank. So I worked in Barbados and Cayman Islands in total a period of about 9 years. And then I got the opportunity through the government of St. Lucia at that time to come back to St. Lucia and to assist St. Lucia in regard to the developments of its offshore sector. So essentially, I undertook the role of being the director of the what is now called the Financial Regulatory Authority, FSRA. I did this for a number of years. And again, I then ventured back into banking, and I was the CEO of a private international bank. And I did this for maybe just a year and more. And then I moved into becoming one of the executive personnel within the East Caribbean Financial Group of Companies. And then after all of this, I figured it was time for me now to go on my own. And I decided to become a consultant. And I worked principally within the region. Grenada, I did some work in Dominica. I did very little in St. Lucia, I must admit. And then one time again, I did get a call from the government of the day to come in and to assist in the regulatory framework of the gaming industry. I did this for a while, and then I was asked to undertake the leadership of CIP, which I kind of wasn't too sure whether it was something that I wanted to do. But eventually I accepted the offer, and that's how I became the CEO of CIP. And really, it's been quite a journey, an enjoyable journey, I must admit. And although it is not in the line of what I've done over many years being in the financial services, it really aligns itself with a lot of things that I've done in the financial services, more so my strong background in anti-money laundering and anti-terrorist financing, and more so my very strong background in risk.
That's the journey, and I've always found that it's almost like for you to be appreciated back home, you need to go outside and ply your trade and get the experience. And that's what you did. CIP, CBI, it's a hot topic, political football. Why don't you tell us why does any of the Caribbean islands, or why does St. Lucia need a CIP or CBI program? And how can we benefit from it?
You know, the whole issue of citizenship by investment program, as is termed within the OECS region, or any other investment migration program in Europe or in Asia, and even now in the Middle East, the Dubai, it's nothing new. St. Kitts has been involved in this program for 30-something odd years. The United Kingdom has been involved in this program, the United States of America. So this is nothing new. But the whole genesis of such a program is to give the government of the country the opportunity to earn what I call sovereign capital, and to earn the sovereign capital at no cost to them, other than the fact that they now have to offer that individual a citizenship and eventually a passport with the investment that they would have made. So it really is a source of revenue for the governments, whether it is in the Caribbean or whether it is in anywhere else in the world. That is the primary purpose of such programs, to generate much needed revenue for the economic development and sustainability of countries around the world.
What is the qualifying criteria for St. Lucia? And, you know, potentially, can you just give us a comparison with maybe other noteworthy islands or sister islands within the region? What's our qualifying criteria?
You know, Anselm, you know, it's always very sad, but that one of the driving criteria within those programs, unfortunately, and it's very beneficial for the investors, is that there's a whole issue of pricing. And so when you speak about comparison, comparisons, unfortunately, is really centered on pricing. And in regard to one of the routes for the grant of citizenship, St. Lucia is maybe one of the most attractive in regard to price points. And even in regard to families, St. Lucia is one, not the only, but is one of the competitive jurisdiction for pricing when it comes to families. But I hold a deep position that in regard to St. Lucia, what would attract an investor to St. Lucia in regard to the CIP program, I strongly suspect a lot more than just the issue of pricing, because there are other routes for the grant of citizenship where in St. Lucia is a lot higher, but yet persons will come to St. Lucia. And it's because of the level of transparency, and the integrity of this program, which would allow persons, attract persons to choose St. Lucia versus any other program, no matter where they are in the world.
In terms of the investment areas, we have, I guess, a recent addition in the COVID-19 bond relief. The National Economic Fund approved real estate projects, approved enterprise projects, and the non-interest bearing government bonds. Can you just take us through some of them quickly and kind of the thresholds?
So there are essentially on our books on legislation, there are essentially four routes that can lead one to be awarded or to be given citizenship. And that is one of those is a National Economic Fund. Let me just say this. St. Lucia is the only island and maybe the only country that I know of where the money is collected by persons who have made that investment for a grant of citizenship. This money goes into what is termed a National Economic Fund. That fund is governed by a board of directors. The board of directors of that fund is really the technocrats within primarily the Ministry of Finance and one private sector person. And they're the ones who essentially manage that fund. So one of the quickest way in which one can be granted citizenship is through that route, which is called the National Economic Fund, or is sometimes loosely termed donation. The other is interest-free government bond. Again, St. Lucia is the only jurisdiction that offers a bond, an interest-free bond, in order that one can be granted citizenship. Now, with COVID, the government again decided that why don't we create a special bond for a limited time to generate some much-needed revenue to deal with the COVID issues and the financing that was required for COVID. And the governor of the central bank alluded to that what he termed a quite innovative method of raising much needed capital, because any governments could have gone to a bank, obtain a loan of anywhere between 7-8%, but there you have a bond that you can offer to the market where there is absolutely no interest to be paid to those bondholders, other than the fact that at the end of the holding period of that bond, the face value will be returned to them. As is done in every bond, with the exception that there's no interest being paid. And then there is the route which I suspect that you'll be very much interested in, is the route through an investment into a government-approved real estate project. And that in itself is one of the most exciting areas, especially for developers who may want to come to St. Lucia, or St. Lucians who may want to partake in any other projects in St. Lucia through the CIP. And the fourth one is the route by what is called an approved enterprise project. Now, when the legislation was first drafted in respect to that particular route, it was envisaged that investors would come on board with the government of St. Lucia to undertake specific projects, whether it's road building, building of a bridge, whatever the case may have been, or even the construction of universities, medical universities, or offshore universities. But the investment amount for this was about $3.5 million. So I think the investment amount was quite high. And therefore, I think a lot of persons don't see that as being quite attractive. So I think at some point in time, we would have to revisit that particular route for the grant of citizenship.
In terms of I'm thinking of the ratio and the relative attractiveness of the different avenues. In as much as I would have liked to get a sense of what's the distribution in terms of subscription. So, for example, which one is the most, most popular route, and which one is the least popular route to citizenship?
Well, you know, because of the price point, the National Economic Fund, the donation as is sometimes referred to, is the most popular route. And most persons would vie to obtain their citizenship through that route. However, The list, as I had said earlier on, is really the approved enterprise project because of the price point. But with the real estate, the COVID bond has done well, but can never surpass that of the National Economic Fund. So I would put the bond, the third runner-up, and the second runner-up would be the real estate. However, I consider real estate surpassing that of the donation, more so as the real estate. There are two approved real estate projects in St. Lucia that are actually open for investments. So you can imagine, as those projects really hit the ground, you can imagine the number of applications that can come through those two projects. And they do have the potential of surpassing the donation, as we see in St. Kitts, as we're now seeing in Grenada to some extent, and it's very glaring in Dominica.
And that's primarily because of the threshold. I think the Dominican qualifying criteria is 100,000 US as opposed to ours, which is 150, correct?
So ours have, it was amended, it's 100,000. But what I was saying was that in regard to Dominica and St. Kitts, notably St. Kitts, the real estate is a great component of revenue from the CIP, simply because of the number of projects, government projects through the CIP that is on the ground and is happening in those two countries.
Tell us about the qualifying criteria for real estate, the threshold, and some of the considerations for persons, both foreign and domestic, who might be interested in that avenue.
The route for citizenship through the real estate is one of the most expensive in the region, and the price point is $300,000. In addition to the initial investment, the applicants are also required to meet an administrative fee. That administrative fee per applicant is at $30,000. And of course, if there are more additions to that application, the administrative fee goes up. So for example, if there's a main applicant with a spouse, it would be the $300,000, which is the main investment amount, plus $45,000 administrative fee. When an individual makes that investment for a grant of citizenship into a government-approved real estate project, that individual then gets legal title to the specific unit or the specific share of that particular project that has been undertaken.
So that's from the applicant perspective. So let me put my real estate investor hat on. What do I need to do for my project to be deemed an approved government CIP project?
Good question. You know, Anselm, before the legislation came into play in 2015, but the legislation was so worded that the only projects that developers could have been part of under the CIP program were either high-end hotels or high-end boutique hotels. So you appreciate that this would have excluded the ordinary developer, even like yourself, to have participated in the real estate component of CIP. But in 2019, the government made a significant amendment to that particular section. And the amendment is really one that says that in addition to the investment, a developer being engaged in a high-end hotel or high-end boutique hotel, it says, or any other project so approved, but with the recommendation of the unit, the CIP unit, and for consideration by cabinet. What this has done is that it has opened the door now for developers like yourself and others to submit a proposal to the CIP unit, a proposal to show the financial viability of such a project that the developer has some stake in that project, some equity in that project, that the developer has an interest or his project can show some sustainability or viability. So that proposal, which is a very detailed, complete business plan with the submission of other documents that would be required by the unit, the unit would go through reviewing that application and would also have Investor Nusha to participate in that review. After those reviews, the unit will then submit its recommendation to the CIP board. There may be instances where the developer may be required to come in and to clear certain issues which the board may want clarification on, or simply the board may just go along with the presentation that would have been made by the unit. But irrespective, the board now would make another recommendation to the Minister Response for Citizenship for onward transmission to Cabinet for a decision to be made in regard to whether that project should be considered a project under CIP.
In terms of some of the minimum requirements, what are we looking at? Is there a minimum number of rooms? So for example, 12 rooms. Right now, the Tourism Incentive Act speaks to having a minimum of 6 rooms. Now, I do recognize, obviously, it's different legislation. But as a broad guide, what is the minimum offering that would be typically considered in terms of number of occupants or units?
No, it's really a good point for discussion. The legislation in its amendment made absolutely no reference, did not identify any parameters in regard to number of rooms, number of units, size of project, unlike the previous provision. So I think it was a deliberate attempt by the government to allow ordinary solutions to undertake specific projects, based on the wording of the legislation, if one wanted to build a 4-unit condominium block, if one wanted to build a restaurant, if one wanted to build a 2-unit accommodation. So there are no set parameters. So therefore, it's all open. But it would be cabinet who would make the decision coming out of the recommendation of the unit whether such a project, irrespective of its size, irrespective of the number of units, irrespective of the initial investment or project cost, is cabinet with the recommendation of the unit who would then make the decision as to whether that project be entitled to be termed a government approved real estate project and therefore to be in a position to allow investors to make an investment and to be granted citizenship.
I think it's clear that it's a lot more inclusive than what obtained before. Take us through the process of the initial application was made, CIP was satisfied with the structure of the business plan, is then now recommended to Cabinet, Cabinet approves it. Tell us the next steps of that process and how we actually go about completing, establishing, selling, and getting the operation to a state where it's a successful going concern.
Good. So that's the exciting part. So as long as government has approved this project under the CIP legislation, it is now transferred to the CIP unit to manage the greater component of this project. And what I mean by this is that CIP has a particular framework under which every developer would work under, irrespective of the size of the project, irrespective of the number of units of this project. So I think the very first thing for the developer And I think I'm hoping that the developer would have done this even before the project was approved, is to get in touch with one of our many international license promoters. These are the firms who are based outside of St. Lucia. Those firms are would more likely be based in those jurisdictions which would favor second citizenship. So those firms would be in China, would be in Middle East, and in Asia. So it'd be important for that developer to engage one of those developers to come on board, or many of those developers to come on board, and to work with them in regard to marketing that specific project in those respective jurisdictions, and as a means of attracting applicants, one, who are looking for citizenship, but are looking for citizenship by making an investment in a real estate and therefore having title to a component of that real estate. So I think the first challenge for any developer would be to get a promoter to be interested and to be sold out in regard to this particular project. Now, for a local developer like yourself, I think if it's not going to be a five-star hotel, it's going to be a condominium unit with, let's say, four units, I think it would be in your interest to find a promoter who truly believes in the project, who truly believes that working with you goes beyond just making money, but it is really something for this country and for you being a local developer. And the reason I'm saying this is that that would drive, or that would determine to a great extent, the commission that that promoter would charge you, the developer, because it's not free. The developer is using, there's costs involved in traveling, whether it is to Syria, whether it is to Dubai, whether it is Malaysia, whether it's China, the developer would have to incur some cost. Of course, you too will have to incur some cost in the marketing component of it, but all promoters would charge a commission. That commission, from my understanding, can be anywhere as high as 30%. And that's a commission that is charged on the initial $300,000. However, that commission doesn't just, although it is based on the $300,000, it's not an easy thing where the developer will say, okay, great, I'll take that 30% from the $300,000 and hand it over to you. It doesn't happen this way. So the developer would have need to have the requisite financial resources to meet that commission payment. What I'm saying here is that when a applicant has been sought and buys into the project and makes that initial investment of $300,000, it does not go into the bank account of the developer. Unlike some countries, that $300,000 goes into an escrow account. Legislation states that this escrow account must be established within a bank in St. Lucia or any other bank so approved by the unit. And the unit has certain criterion that it has established to determine that if it's a bank outside of St. Lucia, which bank would be that bank to hold the escrow account. So those funds go into an escrow account. And then the developer needs to appoint an escrow agent. That escrow agent would have to be approved by the unit. Now, some of the basic things that a unit holds on to. Simple. If you have a real estate project like the Canals project, which is about 732 rooms, you're talking about in excess of $300 million. You can't take an escrow agent or some lawyer who may be involved in managing funds of $200,000. You have to get an escrow agent who is a lot more experienced and who has had the capacity and the ability to handle such funds, because there are severe liabilities as well for the escrow agent. So the escrow agent, however, will be guided in regard to the release of those funds from the escrow account based on what is called a schedule of payments. So in simple terms, to which you as a developer would understand, that we would say, we would agree that we would release 10% of the funds accumulated in the escrow account towards the foundation, another X percent towards the substructure, another X percent for roof. And if there's any amount left in the escrow account, the developer then utilizes it to take care of other miscellaneous expenses outside of the actual structure. So it may be payments for anything, legal fees, whatever the case may be. So the truth is, a local developer like yourself may say, this is not within my reach. Where am I going to get monies to pay a promoter? Or where am I going to get monies to pay the escrow agent? Because the escrow agent, most escrow agents would charge a percentage of the funds held in escrow. But hopefully you would have selected an escrow agent who would be receptive to the fact that it's not a significant project, that it's a local project being managed by a local developer. And hopefully the escrow agent may say, well, you know what? Why don't I charge you a flat fee? But I'm not, CIP unit is not involved in those types of negotiations. And then the developer may think that this is, a local developer may think that this is outside their reach. But I say one simple thing. Outside of CIP, if you as a developer wanted to undertake a construction of a project in St. Lucia, let's say a condominium unit of four units, in simple terms, surely, unless you have the financial capacity to build this condominium unit all on your own financial resources, there'd be no need for you to go to a bank for financing. So the point here is that you are now going to go to the bank, not so much for the financing of the project, because the project will be financed by the investment made by those individuals who are interested in the grant of citizenship. Your financing to the bank would be in regard to meeting those, what I call initial heavy costs. The cost of paying your QS. All of those miscellaneous costs, even before you start construction. And the fundamental cost, obviously, would be the commission payments to the promoters, the marketing of this project, and also the payment to the escrow agent. The truth is, if you worked out your project cost, I'm sure that those monies could be easily recouped somewhere along the line. But St. Lucia's major focus in regard to the real estate is to ensure that the project is completed. Because when you come with the feasibility study at the project and you say to the governor of St. Lucia that the project is going to cost you, let us say in very simple terms, $600,000. It therefore means you owe $600,000. It therefore means you only need two applicants. That's easy. You only need two applicants. What we would not do is go beyond those two applicants. So therefore, the project must be carefully, managed, and within cost. And it's for this reason that we would strongly advise that before you present this project, that you go to a qualified QS who would then review it and come up with a costing of this project, to which we will rely on in regard to making that determination, and hopefully cabinet to make the final decision. I hope that's...
Great explanation. That's fine. My question right now is, while we do the drawdowns for the different stages of the project, at what point do we pay the promoter his up to 30% commission?
You know, again, we don't get involved in this. This would be more of a business decision between you and the promoter. What I can say to you, based on my experience, the promoters have to be paid when the transaction has been completed. The transaction is when they have selected applicant A. The application is submitted to us. The application is approved. You then must pay the commission at that stage.
Okay. And as we pay the commission to the promoter, from your experience, you said it could be a percentage or a flat fee, a business agreement again with the escrow agent. But if you were to give guidance based on past precedents, what kind of percentage are we looking at? Ballpark, and we're not holding you to it. Can we expect to pay an escrow agent for services?
No, I have not. You know, a lot of those agreements are done within closed doors. But from an international level, escrow agents can charge anywhere 1% of the funds held. So all of those things are negotiable. None of those things are fixed in concrete. And I'm a firm believer that our international promoters would be a lot more receptive in working at a reasonable commission rate. And our escrow agents, whoever they may be, I think would be also very much receptive to working with a local developer than it would have been with an international developer who may have a lot more cash to go around.
That's such a loaded statement, a reasonable commission, because real estate agents will tell you in St. Lucia, reasonable commission is 5%. That's what you pay. This is six times more. And more than that, and we're not doing a like-for-like comparison at all. And more than that, at paying full 5% commission, I'm expecting the cost of promotion to be borne by my real estate agent. So they do the campaign, the ad campaign. I may pay for some parts of the videos, but they do the campaign, they do the promotion, social media. They might even do some of the brochures if I give them an exclusive. So at 30% plus, I have to pay some of the marketing costs. My question obviously is, so Mr. Alfred, can I not charge more than $300,000? $300,000 is the minimum, not the maximum. Can I charge $360,000? Can I charge a little more to recoup my commission and my marketing costs?
But yes, you can charge more than $300,000. But I'll tell you one thing. I think you're going to have a dusty time charging more than $300,000. What I mean by this, already this is the most expensive route for the grant of citizenship. Huh? And if an applicant is to make an initial investment into a unit, condominium unit, for example, of more than $300,000, I think you're going to have a very challenging time selling this to our potential applicants. So I would tell you up that I would not advise you to go that route. So you have to make sure that your proposal fits within the $300,000, and all the auxiliary costs are financed by you through a bank, and hopefully you can recoup it somewhere at the end of this project.
Then I can see how much more appealing a boutique hotel, resort type of establishment with a number of amenities can be a lot more attractive and a lot more profitable, because then the room might be 20 by 30, 20 by 20. You have that room, which you would sell for $300,000 within a resort, as opposed to a condominium unit, which might be up to 1,000 square feet, 1,400 square feet. So it doesn't really make a lot of economic sense to do low-density investment of or low-density design of that type. Which brings me to my next question. So I bought it. I flipped my hats now. I'm now an applicant. So I'm into real estate in the US, in China, in Malaysia. I know real estate. So I chose that path because I expect, one, I can get my citizenship, but also I can have an appreciating asset if I buy right. What are some of the conditions of holding that asset before I sell it?
Well, there's one component that we have not yet spoken about. As you would know, if one makes an investment into a real estate, although they have been granted citizenship, you have to give this applicant a return on that investment. That return on investment would have to be determined between you and the applicant. So if it's a low price project, I would want to believe that the investment, the return would be very low. And then the legislation states that you need to hold on to that real estate project for 5 years. So the applicant needs to hold on, the applicant who's now a citizen, sorry, needs to hold on to that project for 5 years. So what the government doesn't want is speculation. After 5 years, you can either buy this particular share or unit from the citizen, or the citizen goes on the market and sells it, or he allows you to go to the market and sell it.
And is that an obligation of the developer? I have made my investment, I've given you nice finishes, great location, through my the creation of my asset, you able to be granted citizenship and access to jurisdictions that you would not have had from your home country. Why must I also now give you a return, a positive return? You already have the asset.
But they are making an investment. They're paying $300,000 for a unit that may not even be worth $300,000. So they expect you to give them a return on investment. And that is the genesis of the CIP approved government projects, is that the applicant makes an investment in this project for $300,000 minimum, and they expect to get a return on that investment within over a 5 year period.
So 5 years is 60 months. The reality of this type of investment, if we were to look at the St. Kitts case, and I do understand why the holding period is that long. A lot of these new citizens will not be coming to the island to live per se within those properties. I will give them rent if we choose to manage the asset for you in your absence. Is there a requirement for them to be on island during that time for minimum amount of time, Nestor?
No, you know, the interesting thing is that those individuals have absolutely no interest in coming to St. Lucia or even seeing physically the investment that they've made. And you're right, they made an investment. You as the developer, the project lead, you now will put this unit on the market. You will get rent for this unit. You give the return or whatever return that you, whether it's 1%, 2%, you give this to the investor and the rest is yours.
Let's flip the script. I went ahead and I constructed my own complex, a 4-unit complex. It's almost finished, and I approached the CIP. I approached your unit. I filled out all the applications. What are some of the distinctions and the considerations for me now? And is that possible at all that after I have funded the project, before it's occupied, I approach the CIP and cabinet for consideration?
Well, you know, you are asking very interesting questions, and I'm not being rude, but the truth is the legislation makes no reference as to at what point one can come to the government. So I don't see this being outside of the discussion.
Okay. So this has been fantastic. As we begin to wrap up, what are some of the inherent risks? And I know that I'm asking you to kind of do a self-examination, if I were to use that phrase. What are some of the inherent risks specifically for minority investors if they were to go down that route to citizenship? Of course, we have the typical construction risks where you might have cost overruns. You may have contracted a promoter who does not bring you the number of clients that you need within the time frame. These are just some of those coming to the top of my head. But what are some of the inherent risks in that form? Or better yet, what are some of the guidelines that you would like to remind potential investors, people who listen to the podcast, for them to keep in mind if they were to consider such a development project?
You know, Anson, maybe we can start out by saying this would be a construction of a project that is debt-free. We start from this concept. So I think from the onset, you would have to be very disciplined in getting to the cost of that project and making any provisions for cost overruns. In regard to the promoters, I think it would be very important for you to select one who has had a history of being very active in pushing applicants towards real estate projects. And I think if you have done that, I think you would have more been in a position to have a successful project under CIP. Again, I start off from the premise that you are going to have a project that would have cost you, let's say, $4 million EC dollars. You can now build this $4 million project without going to a bank for $4+ million. But you would go to the bank for at least a certain sum to cover what I call the initial cost of being part of CIP. But for every developer, they would, especially local developers who may not be building the high-end hotels or high-end boutique hotels, would have to make a decision whether a project that would cost $700,000, whether would it be worth doing this through CIP. But you can only make that decision when you've worked out all the costs and taken into consideration the cost of debt financing of this project, whether it is $2 million, $3 million, or $4 million, versus through CIP, debt-free, but with some initial costs, which must be financed somehow.
Okay. There you have it. Nesta, we want to thank you for taking the time out to speak with us today. So much information. A lot of it is aspirational for many, but I believe that as a property investor, wherever you start in, whether it's just an addition, your first house, your first apartment, your duplex, triplex, fourplex, the more you know, the better prepared you are to make informed decisions. So you've been listening to another episode of Caribbean Property Investing. Remember to check out our Instagram page, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube channel. Like, subscribe, share. And as I always say, everyone needs somewhere to live. Until next time, see you.
I love my community. It teaches you the importance of being together even through difficult times. Business owners doing their best to make it through. Fishermen and farmers working hard to put food on our tables. Nurses caring for the sick shows me who we are made of. People who care. I guess it's about growing together.
To ruminate, to create your ultimate living space. And at Courts, you'll find what you need. Choose from our wide range of furniture, electronics, and accessories to complete your space. We're here and ready to assist. Give us a call to place your order. Shop online at shopcourts.com or visit us in store. So ruminate at Courts, bringing value home.
Congratulations and thank you for tuning in to the Caribbean's first property investing podcast. We want to help Caribbean people create wealth and achieve financial freedom through property investing. Our show provides general advice based on personal experiences and is for educational purposes only. For more information, resources, and past episodes, visit us at CaribbeanPropertyInvesting.com. Remember to click the subscribe button so you never miss a show. Let's go.